At the beginning of the semester, and I just forgot all about this, at the beginning of the semester I said that I wanted to reimburse everybody for the royalties I will, however pitiful they are, I will receive for any new books of mine that anyone purchased. So what I would like you to do, if you, I mean this, because but I need to know how, who bought what. This is not in the spirit of keeping tabs on anybody, so I know how much to pay you back. The Real Utopias books, the money goes to the project, not to me, so I don't get any royalties personally out of the Real Utopias project. But I do on, so I need, so what I, I'll send you all an email about this. What you have to do is send me an email with the purchase price of whatever it cost you to buy whatever you bought, but only for new books. I don't, there are no royalties on used copies, so. And it's, you know, it'll be a dollar or two, depending on how much. So no, I won't feel guilty about it if nobody sends me an email. So I won't know how to reimburse you. But you shouldn't feel any hesitation to do it. Hegemony. Hegemony is a term that was introduced in a serious theoretical way by Gramsci. If you're in Britain, it's pronounced Gramsci. That's how the Brits pronounce it. But in the United States, we say Gramsci. So if you go to a conference in Britain and somebody says Gramsci, you don't have to smirk and say, aha, they don't know how to pronounce it. That's just the British way of doing it. Like Don Quixote in Britain is Don Quixote. There is a certain type of British academic that likes to pronounce, to anglicize pronunciations. I studied at Oxford after my undergraduate degree, studied history, and one of my professors was a French historian named Richard Cobb, a very eminent French historian, who spoke absolutely perfect French, you know, completely, fluently. He was in World War II, he was in the OSS as a French spy or whatever. And he insisted on calling Marseille, Marseilles, and Lyon, Lyons, because that's how upper-class Brits would pronounce those places. Okay, Gramsci, not Gramsci here. Gramsci introduced it, became a influential concept within Marxist discussions in the late 60s, early 70s, with the publication of Gramsci's Prison Notebooks. Sometimes the word hegemony is used to simply mean domination with a capital D, italicized and underscored, you know, sort of real domination. So it's not given any real specificity. So sometimes to describe an ideology as a hegemonic ideology, or a country as a hegemonic country, or a ruling class as a hegemonic class, simply means really, really dominant, as opposed to just dominant. But that's not really Gramsci's meaning. Gramsci wants to describe a hegemonic system, or a hegemonic class, or a hegemonic ideology as a distinctive form of domination. And there are various ways in which he elaborated this, and in which people who have tried to develop this idea have worked on it. Gramsci, for example, at one point described hegemony as force that is, it's consent that's protected by force. Or is it, I think it's consent protected by force. I think the most useful way of thinking about this concept as a general concept, and then applying it more specifically to the question of ideology, is the way that Chantal Mouffe has elaborated it in her essay, Gramsci and hegemonic ideology or hegemony in Gramsci or whatever. It's the her essay that was assigned for this session. She is a French philosopher, social theorist. She may be by training a sociologist, I'm not sure. Married to Ernesto Laclau, who's an Argentinian expatriate living in France. They have written work together and separately. Laclau is especially well known for his work on populism in Latin America. I actually like Mouffe's work better than Laclau. Laclau is the more famous of the couple, but I've often found his works pretty impenetrable and very hard to kind of nail down exactly what the arguments were. And when I did nail them down, I didn't tend to agree with them. Whereas Mouffe I found extremely interesting and perceptive. And particularly this essay on hegemony, for me, was really one of the very best things written. She builds the argument around a contrast between, or at least the way I would describe her argument. If you think of the contrast between a leader and a boss, both leaders and bosses are obeyed. That is, in both the case of a leader and a boss, people do what they're told to do. But the reasons why people follow a boss and follow a leader are quite different. A boss tells you what to do, and the background for your agreeing to do what you're told is the threat of some kind of sanction. The boss, therefore, is exercising direct power over you. A leader induces you to do things by virtue of the assurances that you have that the leader actually has your interests at heart. That when the leader tells you to do something, even if you don't quite understand the reasons, if it's a leader that you trust, what that means is you believe that the leader is not going to tell you to do things that are bad for you. The leader has your interests at heart. Now, in these terms, Gramsci argues, ruling classes can either be like bosses or like leaders. When they're like bosses, they dominate, force compliance under various kinds of threats. When they are leaders, they have some capacity to link the interests of subordinate classes to their own interests. In the pursuit of a social project which is good for them, for the leader, it reproduces the ruling class, but it also brings along with it at least some significant interests of subordinate classes. The expression, what's good for General Motors is good for America, is a hegemonic claim. That is, it's a claim that the interests of General Motors contain within them universal interests for everybody in the society. And to the extent that there is some truth in that claim, that is, to the extent that General Motors has a project of accumulation and of social development, which, if carried out, will bring benefits to a wide range of people who are not ruling class members of the General Motors Corporation, to the extent that that's true, General Motors is exercising leadership of the society, giving it a collective project to which the interests of significant parts of subordinate classes are tied. That's an affirmation of the hegemonic character of the American capitalist class, that expression. The hegemonic character of the American capitalist class in the 1950s. And Gramsci would say that that claim was not a complete illusion. The claim that what's good for General Motors is good for America was not pure deception. It captured something about the character of the class project of the American capitalist class in that period, which would make it appropriately described as a hegemonic project, not merely a dominant one. Michael Burlevoy, in his work on labor processes, distinguishes between two kinds of factories, what he calls despotic organization of work and the hegemonic organization of work. in the hegemonic organization of work, productivity is assured through a game in which competition among workers striving to increase their individual incomes and, as he puts it, make out on the shop floor, has the effect of directing their activity in ways that enhance the productivity, which is good for capitalists. So in the hegemonic workshop, competition is organized in such a way that individual strategies of improvement of workers contribute to productivity enhancement, but also do, in fact, the rules of the game allow for individual benefits to workers from those strategies. Whereas in a despotic organization, productivity is enforced mainly through surveillance, discipline, and control, and threats. Now, this doesn't mean that in the hegemonic system there aren't some threats also. It doesn't mean that it's a game of pure consent. There are also threats, but the threats primarily are designed to maintain the rules of the game, within which a coordination of interests become possible, at the micro level in Burrowboy's case. Well, how does this apply to the question of ideology? So Mouffe says, this notion of leadership doesn't apply simply to the political roles of capitalist corporations or their economic role in the accumulation process. We can also talk about moral and intellectual leadership of a class. A class can give moral and intellectual coherence in ways that can be described as leadership rather than just domination. Well, what could this possibly mean? How should we think about moral and intellectual leadership using that leadership boss contrast? The way to think about this is to think about two different ways that we can imagine talking about ideological struggles. So this is Mouffe's characterization of the problem. Here are two contrasting visions of what it means to say there exists an ideological struggle between bourgeois and socialist ideology, let's say. One view is that ideological struggle consists of two contending ideologies that are antagonistic on every point within their ideology. This is what she refers to as a confrontation of two paradigmatic ideologies. You have a proletarian normative ideology, which is rooted in the interests of the working class and involves moral visions of an alternative world of equality and democracy. And you have a bourgeois ideology, which is rooted in the interests of the capitalist class, which is based on individualism, competition, private property, and hierarchy. And these are paradigmatic ideologies. They're each internally coherent. They differ on every point. Each element is the negation of the other. And they do battle to confronting paradigms. That's one vision of ideological struggle. Another vision is much more complicated. Contending ideologies contain many of the same elements, but they are organized into a different matrix. She refers to these, therefore, as the matrix of ideology. The belief in individual freedom, for example, is present in both bourgeois and proletarian ideology. It's not that proletarian ideology is against individual freedom. It's for individual freedom. But because this concept is linked to private property in a different way in proletarian and bourgeois ideology, it acquires a different meaning. In the former, and both bourgeois and proletarian ideology have notions of private property. That is, there's nothing in proletarian ideology which says people can't own their own clothing, for example. That, you know, I see that you have a nice hat and I can just come over and take it and put it on my head. No, that people have some things which they have special rights to, and that not everything is everybody's all the time. So there is a notion of private property, even in a revolutionary socialist ideology, and there's notions of individual freedom. The differences in how these things are articulated to each other, how they're connected. In bourgeois ideology, the link between individual the link is between individual freedom and private property, whereas in socialist ideology, individual freedom is linked to collective self-determination. There's a different linkage that gives individual freedom its meaning. Ideological struggle, in this view, is struggle over the articulation of elements rather than over the elements themselves. It's struggle on the terrain of ideology rather than struggle between paradigmatic ideologies. This then enables us to understand hegemony in a different way. A hegemonic ideology is an ideology in which the dominant group has incorporated into its own ideology key elements that come from popular forces, but has done so in a way that re-articulates them, incorporates them in a new matrix, and then accordingly tames them of their oppositional character. The incorporation, however, is real, not just illusory, and the dominant ideology is changed. The ruling class ideology is changed by that incorporation. The incorporation, for example, of the element democracy within bourgeois ideology. Democracy is now an absolutely integral element of bourgeois ideology. Many of the things the United States does around the world is in the name of democracy, right? There's hardly an element that's more central to popular ideology than democracy. And that's where it came from. The demand for democracy is a popular demand. It's a demand of workers, it's a demand of oppositional social movements and social forces. It gets incorporated into the ruling ideology, gets rearticulated to other elements, acquires a different meaning as a result of its insertion into this new matrix, but that insertion does actually change the dominant ideology. And it changes it in ways that makes that dominant ideology have more the character of leadership, moral and intellectual leadership, rather than just domination. It becomes a less alien ideology. It's less alien from the interests and preoccupations of the masses. And it's also more sensitive to articulating needs and interests. It becomes an ideology that's more capable of absorbing opposition and responding to interests of various sorts than is an ideology that's a pure ideology of domination. Within this perspective on ideology, then, on hegemony, what you want to do if you want to analyze an ideology and then to analyze struggle is to first of all figure out what are the elements of the ideology, what are its components, and how do they fit together. So here's just as an illustration of this. Here are five elements that I think we can all agree are elements of bourgeois ideology. I think these are all also elements of a socialist ideology. All of these elements would appear in both. There are other elements which might also be in a socialist ideology, but these would be five common elements. So freedom, democracy, private property, equality, and let's say prosperity rather than material well-being. So these are five elements. Now we know from kind of elementary language study, that words get their meaning from sentences, right? That a word gets its meaning from its connection to other words, because of contrasts, because of definitional linkages of various sorts. Words don't have their meaning simply as standalone, atomized abstractions. That's why dictionaries are, you have to know a language to read a dictionary, right? Definitions are always in terms of other words. How are these articulated? How should we think of their connections? Well, this could be a lively discussion. Let me just begin it by talking about some connections. These are on page 3 of my notes, if you have the notes there. First of all, let's look at freedom. Freedom in bourgeois ideology means freedom from coercion by the state. This implies the sanctity of private property. That is, the way in which freedom from coercion by the state, one of the ways in which it's articulated within a bourgeois ideology, is the importance of private property. Because private property means things you own that the state cannot interfere with, and the state protects from other people interfering with. That's what it means to have private property. So in bourgeois ideology, there's a very tight connection between individual freedom and private property. That's a tight linkage, in which private property can either be seen as the central expression of individual freedom or as the foundation of individual freedom. Those are perhaps almost equivalent formulations. Democracy in bourgeois ideology depends upon private property and is the form of the state, democracy is, that protects freedom. So why do we want democracy? The main value of democracy is that it protects individual freedom. And it depends upon private property. Without private property, no democracy. Milton Friedman wrote a book, Capitalism and Freedom, which is essentially all about that thesis, which he says, if you get rid of private property, you destroy democracy. Why? Because if you don't have private property, the state will concentrate so much power that it will prevent democracy. The only way in which to have democracy is to have a large sphere of activity which the state cannot interfere with. That provides the foundation for the possibility of democracy. So for, and I think that's a general expression of the standard view within bourgeois ideology. Democracy protects freedom, but it depends upon private property. Democratic constraints on private property are an affront to freedom. So in the link between democracy and private property, you have that private property is the foundation for democracy, but democratic power over private property is a violation of freedom. So if you're looking at those three terms, democracy, freedom, and private property, you'd have that complex articulation, set of sentences that link them together. Democracy depends on private property, but if democracy interferes with private property, that is an affront to freedom, that weakens freedom. Equality means equality of citizenship rights. That is, equality in, with respect to democratic rights, not equality of material conditions. Prosperity is maximized by the combination of freedom plus private property. Individual freedom to make choices and private property. Those two together give you a market. Individual freedom plus private property equals the market, and the market generates material well-being. Okay, so you could go on and elaborate more connections, but that's an example of what it would mean to articulate these elements. A socialist ideology, one view would be that what a socialist ideology wants to do is to negate each of these bourgeois elements. An alternative is to say that what socialist ideology does is re-articulate them, combines them in a different way.
True democracy depends upon equality of material well-being. So equality is linked to material well-being or to prosperity. That is, actually, material well-being is better than prosperity for the purpose. Material conditions of life. Equality is linked to material conditions of life, not simply to civil rights, to democratic rights. And democracy depends upon equality of material well-being rather than upon private property. That you can't have true democracy unless you have equal citizens, and you can't have equal citizens if you have big inequalities of material conditions of life. So true democracy, in a socialist rearticulation, depends upon the quality of material conditions of life. Freedom means freedom to do things, not just freedom from state coercion. Equality means both equality of rights and equality of material conditions of life. And democracy should constrain private property in order to enhance real freedom. That is, real freedom is the real ability of people to do things, to put their life plans into effect. And in order to enhance real freedom for all, democracy has to constrain private property. So instead of private property being the foundation of democracy, democracy dominates private power, private property, allowing it only insofar as it's compatible with enhancing real freedom for people, rather than giving it a privileged status as the foundation for freedom. And again, you can elaborate in other ways these rearticulations. Now, ideological struggle then in this conception is a much more complicated affair, because it means you don't simply reject bourgeois freedoms. You rather appropriate them and reconnect them to a broader range of elements. This also corresponds to a certain kind of intuition in the Marxist tradition about that's embodied in sort of dialectics in a kind of formal way, in dialectical understandings of the world. Opposition to an existing world implies transcending it rather than simply destroying it. And there is this formula in the kind of Hegelian tradition of a thesis and an antithesis and a new synthesis, right? Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, that's the kind of formulaic way of thinking about dialectics. Well, this has more of that character, because it implies that a new ideology involves a kind of synthesis emerging out of a confrontation over the articulation of elements, rather than simply an absolute point-by-point negation of everything. A similar kind of point can be made about intellectual leadership. This was more on the moral leadership side. A similar point can be made about intellectual leadership, providing ideological understandings of how the world works. To be hegemonic, bourgeois ideology cannot simply deny the lived experience of workers, dismiss the categories of everyday life that come out of people's lives in a capitalist society, but rather these categories have to be appropriated and integrated into an intellectual struggle structure that's coherent and compelling. But does so in a way which supports rather than undermines the domination of that class. This is what effective propaganda does. What effective propaganda does is not deny the lived experience of people, but rather appropriates it and integrates it within a framework that makes sense to people, corresponds to some common sense, but does so in a way that excludes certain kinds of interpretations and emphasizes others in ways that reinforces the interests of the dominant class. Within this general framework, then, the task of ideological struggle is a task of what can be called building a counter-hegemony. That is, it's not just trying to defeat an ideology, it's trying to reorganize an ideology. And this can be an extremely difficult thing to do, because whenever a successful challenge is raised and voiced, it risks being incorporated back into the hegemonic ideology. A very good example of this, I think, comes from the feminist movement, from the women's liberation movement of the 60s and 70s. A graduate student here in the 80s, Cynthia Costello, did a very interesting master's thesis on the incorporation of women's liberation symbols in advertising. And there was, in the 80s, some famous ads that showed women construction workers. You know, they're women with tool belts and boots on a construction site. I forget what they were advertising. Or women executives, but dressed in very fashionable clothing with men adoringly surrounding them. These were cases, she argued, in which women's liberation symbols, which were oppositional, the woman executive, a powerful woman, or a woman construction worker, were oppositional symbols. They got integrated and connected to conventional bourgeois symbols in these ads in ways then which transformed the meaning of the configuration. And so the counter-hegemonic symbols got neutralized by being incorporated into the new ads. They were inserted then into a new matrix. Liberation becomes a reaffirmation of commodity production, individualism, and even of male domination in some of these ads. That is, the particular way that the construction worker was represented in the ad was still as a very sexualized being. So it was an extremely attractive, glamorous woman dressed as a construction worker with all these sort of men around her ogling her. And I forget what it was an ad for. But it became a reaffirmation in a new articulation of subordination. So that's one of the challenges to counter-hegemonic struggles. The problem is, if you refuse to engage the hegemonic ideology and attempt to rearticulate those elements, you risk marginalization. If you engage in that kind of struggle, you risk co-optation. That's, if you recall, the same problem that socialist movements faced with respect to democratic practices. And that's why bourgeois democracy is a hegemonic system. A hegemonic system, in this sense, can be thought of as a game in which to participate in the game risks being integrated and co-opted. To refuse to participate risks being marginalized. If you refuse to engage in a struggle on the terrain of ideology to rearticulate these elements, you risk being marginalized and seen as a sect, a fringe group that is simply rejecting everything that's of value in the society. If you participate by saying, yes, I'm a socialist, but I believe in individual freedom, but we mean by individual freedom this, I believe in democracy, but what I mean by democracy is this. So you're not just simply attacking everything. You're accepting the terms that are the dominant terms of discourse and saying they have to be rearticulated. Well, then you risk being absorbed as well. Yeah.
So then you can draw an analogy between Shavorsky's argument about participation in the political aspects of the state and this.
Okay. Yeah. It's essentially the same kind of argument. Do you participate on the terrain of democratic politics, or do you fight against that whole system? Do you participate on the terrain of ideology and struggle on that terrain, or do you reject the whole thing? And the dilemma is risking marginalization or risking absorption. I think in a way, one way of identifying that a system is a hegemonic system is that those dilemmas are forced on you. You can't, by an act of will, imagine to simply reject the dilemma. The dilemma is real, it's imposed on you. You face the choice of marginalization or absorption or co-optation. Social movements can be on the fringe and be marginalized, or they can be on the center stage but risk being co-opted. Now, the fact that you risk being co-opted doesn't mean that you become fully absorbed. I mean, that's just the dilemma. The pressures are towards co-optation and absorption and integration. But there are various ways through strategies of the organization, through the kinds of educational and cultural practices in which they engage, in which that those pressures can be perhaps mitigated. All right, that's the story of hegemony, at least of ideological hegemony as I see it. And I would encourage you, when you read things, to keep this idea in mind and to avoid using the term hegemony as the kind of catch-all expression for just generic strong domination. It should really have this notion of leadership and articulation of elements where there are forms of real compromise involved. The Chavorsky's account is therefore also about hegemony in the political sphere. My arguments around class compromise are also about hegemony. Class compromises are what are the forms of struggle appropriate within a hegemonic system. Within a hegemonic system, a class compromise is a way of advancing, destroying the furniture. Let me briefly make some comments about the legitimation theme, which is a more familiar one than hegemony. That's why I'm not going to spend as much time. And I think unlike on the last couple of lectures, I won't let this spill over to the next session. So on Wednesday, we're going to do the micro foundations of ideology, not finish up the legitimation. Legitimation is basically the normative aspect of ideology. It's the answer to the questions, what is good? Some people think that this is the most important aspect of ideology. That is, the most important thing is for people to think that capitalism is desirable, that it's a morally good thing. I myself think that that the legitimation aspect is probably less important than the issues of mystification. That is, people's beliefs about how it actually works has a lot to do with why they think it's good or bad. So if you actually believe that the kinds of poverty and disadvantage that we see in capitalism are generated by capitalism, then you're likely to have a much more critical view of capitalism than if you think that those things are generated by cultural failures in the communities of poor people and it has nothing really to do with the market and with capitalism. So your belief about how capitalism works will have a lot to do with your judgment about whether it's a good or bad thing, as opposed to your judgments about the desirability of it being independent of your belief about how it functions. Now, some people, libertarians, for example, believe it's a good thing independently of their beliefs about whether it makes people's lives go well. Libertarians say it's irrelevant whether or not capitalism makes people's lives go well. Most people could suffer under capitalism, and it would still be a good thing to a libertarian because it properly maps people's rights with respect to their control over property and their freedom from interference by the state. So that's a claim about certain kinds of intrinsic rights and desire and goods that you have by virtue of particular kinds of relations irrespective of whether or not the system organized in that way creates a lot of suffering. Robert Nozick, for example, has, you know, in his Anarchy State and Utopia, one of the important defenses of libertarian views of capitalism, says that it may be that people should feel a moral obligation to help the poor because the poor are harmed by private property, but that's up to each individual to decide on the basis of their own moral principles, that they have no, the state has no right to force people to be charitable. And that's because people have absolute rights over their property. And to force people to be charitable, that is by taxing them, is to impose a harm, an unjustified harm on people in order to solve a problem. Two wrongs don't make a right, is a sense be the slogan of a libertarian. But nevertheless, I think that mystifications are probably more fundamental because they support legitimation. This doesn't mean that I don't think legitimations are irrelevant. I do think it's important what values people hold, what they believe is desirable and undesirable. And to some extent, those values do have autonomy from people's assessment of their consequences. This gets very complicated very quickly if you really try to think about it. There's, in philosophical discussions about legitimation and norms, there's this notion of ultimate values and instrumental values. So some values you hold, some things you think are desirable, you think that they're desirable because they're good for something else, and some things you think are desirable for intrinsic reasons. So mostly people think, for example, that being healthy is desirable for intrinsic reasons. It's not that you believe it's good to be healthy because it enables you to make money, right? It's true that being healthy enables you to make money, but it's more likely you believe that it's important to have money because it might contribute to your health. You know, you're more likely to be healthy and happy if your money or happiness is a good case. Some people believe that happiness doesn't need, and it's not that it's valuable for some other purpose. It's just a valuable thing in and of itself. Now this gets very tricky when you try to hierarchize some of these values with respect to others, because so often they're deeply interdependent. Is happiness really an ultimate value, or is there something a little bit vaguer, which is all things considered well-being, of which happiness is a component? But if we think of your, if, for example, if you're just introspecting and thinking about what's important to you, and you think about the meaningfulness of your life and happiness, well, if you feel your life is meaningless, that's going to make you unhappy. But you can feel things are meaningful and still be unhappy, because there can be things that can make you very unhappy, and you can still feel that there's purpose in what you're doing. So purpose and meaning have a value independently of their connection to happiness. Those are values. Legitimation refers to how you link existing social arrangements to those values. To talk about a system being legitimate is to claim that you have a set of values and you believe that the existing system is in conformity in, to a greater or lesser extent, or to a better or lesser extent than other alternatives with respect to those values. A system is fully legitimate if you feel it really conforms to your deepest values. A system has high legitimacy if you feel, for all of its imperfections, alternatives will violate your values to a greater extent. In discussions about legitimation, or around these normative aspects of ideology, this is one of the places where this earlier discussion we had about culture and ideology really come into play. Because many of these things that are thought of as values apply both to unconscious aspects of your dispositions as well as conscious things that you believe are good. Just as an example, most people believe it's a good thing to be kind, and some people really are kind. And people who are not particularly kind can still believe it's a good thing to be kind. Kindness is a value which people who are kind of nasty could still hold as a value. It's just that their own dispositions and angers and aspects of their character make it hard for them to act on that value. Same thing for competitiveness. People can believe it's good to compete with other people. This is a desirable way of life. It's a good thing, but they may or may not be particularly competitive themselves. Two more minutes here. On pages 6 and 7, I run through a variety of explanations for the kinds of norms that we believe in, the sorts of values and moral codes that we hold, and how we apply them to social institutions. Some of these we'll actually be discussing on Wednesday when we talk about the micro foundations. A lot of the issue about how the normative aspect of ideology is acquired, how people come to hold the beliefs they hold about what is good, a lot of that discussion ultimately is about the micro foundations of beliefs. How do people acquire these kinds of beliefs? Is it through indoctrination and socialization? Is the main way that people acquire the beliefs about what is good by directly being taught these beliefs in the forms of media, role models, television, schools, hero worship, education, and so on? Are they inculcated? Is that the main way we should think about this? Or are beliefs about what is good to a significant result of internal cognitive processes which are not the result of direct inculcation? Cognitive dissonance, which is one of the things we'll talk about on Wednesday, would be an example. You come to believe that certain things are good or bad, not by being taught that they're good or bad, but by various kinds of psychological processes that shape your beliefs about what's good or bad. The classic example of cognitive dissonance is the Aesop fable of the fox and the grapes, where the fox decides the grapes are sour because the fox can't get to the grapes. And the belief in the desirability of those grapes changes because of their unattainability. That's a cognitive process. It's not that anybody told the fox grapes are bad. The fox comes to believe that they're sour because they're unattainable. The third and fourth, just very briefly, the third way that values of particular sorts can be acquired, can be believed, has to do with deep aspects of character structure. Rather than because of direct inculcation of beliefs, being taught them as such, or through cognitive processes of belief formation, which can change fairly rapidly depending upon the context that those cognitive processes would be shaped. Psychoanalysis stresses the way in which beliefs are formed by virtue of their congruence with underlying character structures, so that, for example, fascist beliefs are believed by people because they correspond to a fascist or authoritarian personality. The authoritarian character of the belief system about it's good to follow orders, it's good to be obedient, it's good to have a all-powerful father in the world that will guide your country, sort of the authoritarian belief structure, is rooted in an authoritarian personality, which is generated through severe disciplining in early childhood. Not because the severe disciplining teaches a content, it's not because of direct messages that are told, it's not that you're constantly instructed with the words, it's good to follow an all-powerful father. Rather, it's by being beaten and disciplined in a very harsh way that disposition is inscribed in one's character. After the Second World War, there was a lot of interest in this, in a famous book by Adorno and various others called The Authoritarian Personality, which argued that the Nazi Party was able to gain such strength in Germany because of a much higher prevalence of authoritarian personalities in the basic character structure of Germany because of all sorts of practices, rather than because of the messages per se. And finally, there's a view that these norms actually are basically just people following rules of the game, that the rules of the game reward competitiveness, and so people come to think of competitiveness as desirable because it's the way you win in the game, and that it's very much the active practice of these norms inscribed in the rules which constitute them as norms, and therefore challenging them really means resisting and undermining such norms. You have to challenge the norms themselves. It's not so much you have to challenge the beliefs, you have to challenge their practical embodiment in the rules. When you, okay, we're over time. This is all perfectly good segue into the micro foundations, which we will discuss on Wednesday.